I think, as all of you kind of saw in the Gov delivery notification that I sent out earlier about this, I don't think this is the advanced credits discussion is going to take the whole time. And so we will take the opportunity, since we have you all here together, to kind of go back over all of the other topics and do a summary of all of the proposals. So basically starting from the first draft meeting and walking through all of them just to catch you up on the discussions that we've been having, the meetings that we've been having, kind of like a summary of the comments so far that we've received, and just kind of what additional research and additional kind of thoughts that we have. And so hopefully you'll get kind of be able to kind of catch up to all of the different things that we've been talking about in this in this rulemaking. So the agenda today, we'll go through introductions of the DEQ staff that are on call today, and then we'll head into the topic about the advanced credit. We'll see how long it really takes to get through and whether we need a break or not. And then head into the other topics after the break. I have a feeling that we'll probably, a short break will probably good because it's the second half, it's the other topics that may actually take a while to kind of get through. And then a public comment and then wrap up for the next step. So, introductions on the DEQ side first. Hi, this is Corey. I will let you know that Colin McConaughey could not, make it today as well. So you've got the rest of the CFP team on the line. So Bill, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi there, I'm Bill Peters. I'm an analyst with the Clean Fuels Program.
Also on the call, we've got Stephanie.
Good morning, everyone. This is Stephanie Summers. I'm an analyst with the program as well, and I work in clean reporting.
Thanks, Justin. Kiara?
Hi, my name is Kiara Winnings, and I am the life cycle assessment expert on the team.
Okay, thanks everybody. We'll go to the next slide then. So just some ground rules, game ground rules that we use for the other meetings. I think other meetings have been really well. The participation has been really good with everybody else. And I think, the routine now that, if you have a question, please put it in the chat so that everybody can see it. And Bill will be monitoring the Zoom today. So please raise your hand if you do want to have a comment. And then if you are on the phone, to press star 9 to raise your hand. And a reminder that when you do speak, if you can state your name and your affiliation when you provide your comments, that would be fabulous. Anything else on the ground rules, Bill? No.
Just a reminder, the raise hand button is in the participant box, too.
Okay, next slide. So here is the timeline for this rulemaking. And I think what you'll see, as I highlighted in red, is a proposal that I want to throw out to the group today. So where we are today is meeting 4, and we'll talk about events Saturday. And then, like I said, at the end of events Saturday proposal, then we'll talk about a summary of all of the rest of the proposals. Meeting 5, 2 weeks from now, on November 19th, was intended to be the fiscal and economic impact analysis discussion. I think what the sense that I have right now is that I think in the Gov delivery, as you all noticed, that I don't know what the word is, but I basically signaled that we would have draft rules ready for this meeting. So part of that is true. We do have draft rules for the advanced crediting provisions up and posted on the website, but we don't have any additional ones. I was really hoping to have The next two sets that we are working on, the EER rules about how to apply for and obtain an EER adjusted carbon intensity as a means to have an administrative new vehicle, enter and generate credits in the program. That part is drafted, but we did not get posted today. And the draft rules for the renewable electricity provisions are also not ready yet. As you can imagine, there's still lots of discussions going on about the details of those rules, so they were not ready to be posted yet. So what I'm going to propose is that the next meeting is that we have a meeting where we cover all of the draft rules. And so we'll commit to having at least, a full set of everything that we think we're going to touch as far as the rulemaking proposal, and that we use the November 19th meeting to go through that. I really wanted an opportunity for all the stakeholders to know where we are with kind of all of the different elements that we talked about, which then means we need to schedule an additional meeting to have that fiscal and economic impact analysis discussion. Right now, I'm proposing that we add a sixth meeting, and that the meeting six currently proposed for December 2nd, which is the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. I don't know yet if that's going to be a morning or an afternoon. So if you can hold that date for a wrap meeting, that would be great. I will note that many of you participate in the Oregon EV collaborative process, and that afternoon there is a tentative hold for a meeting that afternoon, and I'm trying to work with Kristen Wright to be able to kind of see if that meeting can actually be changed so we can have the RAC meeting that afternoon instead. There are, people that on the DEC side that want to be able to make this fiscal meeting, and so we're trying to we're really trying to have this advisory committee meeting on the first, and so we'll see what we can do and work around with the Oregon EV collaborative process. So I'll just put a pin in that for now, and once we get through the discussion today, at the end of the meeting we'll come back and see how you feel. How you feel about whether we can really make it, how to accommodate this additional meeting. I've worked out the schedule with our rulemaking coordinator, and I still believe we can still be on the same adoption timeline. So what this means, though, is that the beginning of the comment period will be more late December than mid-December. And then that would start the formal comment period. That means we would have a public hearing in late January and then end the comment period soon thereafter. And to still meet an ECC meeting that is in March. The ECC has not set what date that they're going to meet in March, but usually it's the second half of the month. And so I also have to coordinate with ECC staff to figure out what the timing of that is. So anyway, so that is the proposal for now. And like I said, keep it in the back of your head as we progress through the agenda for today. Okay, next slide. So again, the goal for this meeting is this is the first time we're taking a deeper dive into the advanced credit provisions. While we do have some proposals as far as what our recommendations are to move forward with this, we are definitely interested in hearing your thoughts about what works, what doesn't work, what you think we've missed, and tweaks that we have to the proposal that we'll throw out today. I do think that there's lots of opportunity for feedback in this discussion for the advanced credit. Okay, so with that, I am going to turn over the presentation of this provision to Bill.
Hey, everybody. Okay, so I'm going to get started here. So we do have the discussion draft rules posted on our website for this revision. They went up yesterday evening, or late yesterday, so I won't have expected all of you to read it in stunning amounts of detail. So we'll go over broadly what we wrote in the rules and describe that here. I'll stop at a couple of different points along the way in order to take comments and to ask some specific questions. And as always, if you have any clarifying questions, please raise your hand or put those questions in the chat box, and we'll try and take them as we go. For broader discussion of the rules, we'll try and hold that towards the end, if that's okay, other than the specific questions I'll be calling out along the way. So the first part here, advanced credits are designed to be another tool to help advance the state's transportation electrification goals. Our aim with this revision is to help lower the initial cost of conversion to electric vehicles for fleets. What this revision will do is the credits will still be real valid reductions under the program and under our applicable statutes. It just means that we're issuing those credits for, in advance of the actual reductions occurring when the electric vehicles are fueled and charged electricity. The advanced credits will represent actual reductions of greenhouse gas emissions against the clean fuel standards set by this program. As you'll see, we've tailored the eligibility criteria and other portions of the rules to ensure that that occurs and to ensure that a party is responsible for making sure that, real credits do get generated, and if not, any advanced credits that end up not getting generated are replaced and the system is made whole. Any vehicles receiving advanced credits must be registered with and largely operating within the state of Oregon. This question came up once or twice, so I'll just take it here in the past. The goal is not that, you cannot have the state, or you can't have the vehicle leave the state on an incidental trip. It's just that the majority of miles are in Oregon. It's based in Oregon. It's a electric school bus in Astoria and it goes across Columbia River to take some kids to a basketball game. That's fine. We're not talking about the incidental trip here. We're just, the vehicle needs to be within the state of Oregon and generating credits in the state of Oregon for the vast majority of its miles is what our goal is. So for our initial eligibility criteria here, what we're proposing in the draft rule and the discussion draft of the rules that's up is that the following entities can apply for and potentially be approved to receive advanced credits. Public transit agencies, political subdivisions of the state of Oregon, which is legal for basically cities, counties, and other state agencies within the state. Tribes within the state of Oregon, school districts, and then companies that are under contract to provide services to a political subdivision of the state of Oregon or an Oregon school district. So that would be like contractors who are providing school bus services. It could also mean garbage haulers that are under a franchise agreement with a local government. So the first question we have here, and people can chime in now or wait till we get to the end of this, is are there any additional entities we should consider? I think, as we discussed at the first meeting a little bit, our goal for this eligibility list was to give us entities that are very likely to have vehicles in Oregon and keep them in Oregon. We discussed a more broad version of private fleets internally, and I think some of our concerns were, how much assurance could we get from vehicles, won't be rehoused out of state. So that was our initial thinking here. We have a question in the chat, but I think that will get answered in a second when I go to the next slide, so I'll take that in a moment. Michael Graham, you've got your hand raised. Do you want to chime in here quickly?
It's Bill, Michael Graham with Clean Cities. I think of also organizations, maybe they are private, that are utilizing publicly owned space. Primarily, in my example, thinking of perhaps airlines at airports. Mm-hmm. I also see that non-road is not explicitly called out, so I can hold that question for later.
Yeah, I think that the provision wasn't intended to be limited to just on-road here. I don't think we've got any language in there that specifically says it has to have be on, you know, operating on public highways. If it is off-road, I think that would be eligible under the current discussion draft of the rules. For the airline example, I guess I'm just curious how you would envision that working. Are you saying that, like, are we talking about, like, ground support equipment, or?
I mean, that's probably one example of eligible equipment. What about, that's the first one that comes to mind, at least.
Gotcha. Okay. If you want to file comments on that in written form, that would be great. I think as I said a moment ago, we're just trying to, where we send it to private operators, have some assurance that it will, definitely stay within the state, as we would claw back any credits or require them to retire credits against any vehicles that leave the state toward the end of the payback period.
And you wouldn't consider private organizations for non-road applications if the non-road applications are, staying in Oregon for the duration of the payback period?
I think it's really what led to this initial eligibility list was our consideration of the risk of of the vehicles that are covered by the agreement leaving the state. And our judgment was that it was, public fleets, are very unlikely to have their vehicles leave the state. I mean, maybe they would sell them at some point if they needed to, but generally, a vehicle owned by the city of Eugene is not going to get moved to Chico, California or something, right? So that was our consideration there, was we were trying to get the eligibility criteria for who can apply to entities that are extremely likely to keep their vehicles in state until basically the end of their useful life, or at least until the end of the payback period for these credits.
Sure. On the non-road side, for at least private entities, that might be a good compromise, because those are going to likely stay at their, fixed location for a very long time, especially when you're looking at non-road diesels. Those are quite old. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you'd consider that as another eligible entity. I think that would also provide some serious air quality benefits and, a lot of non-road likely operating close to priority populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're open to considering that. I think that, as you'll see, we have an agreement basically that the operator would need to go into. I think we could consider that, and we'd like to see comments. And also, it would help if we had like an identified private fleet that was saying that they would like to take advantage of this provision, so that we could, analyze it with them in mind. With that, I'm going to go to the next person with their hand raised.
Let me jump in on that too, Michael. I think the other thing that we're trying to balance here is, I know several people have asked us this question, well, is there going to be a point where we're going to be generating too many credits? And that's partially why we're trying to kind of balance that here as well. As you'll see in the proposal, we're proposing an application period so that we have some sense of how many fleets are actually interested in, and that's kind of like the other way that we have to kind of manage the amount of credits that are going to be generated.
Totally understand.
V, you had your hand raised. Please go ahead.
So, hi, this is V. Thanks for with Climate Solutions. And my comment, this probably falls under like companies under contract to provide service, but just thinking about nonprofits and other organizations that provide public service to Oregonians that might not necessarily have a contract with a political subdivision, but have fleets. And so definitely think that they should also be considered in this section as well.
Thank you. David Green, your hand is up next. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, this is David with the Port of Portland. And I just want to emphasize what Michael stated, in that when you look across the board about where you can have the greatest impact in transitioning to lower carbon fuels more broadly across fleets, it's probably going to be on the private sector rather than public agencies. And Michael's example is really good. Like airport ground support equipment, airlines are not under contract with the port. they're under an airline agreement, so that's much different. But that's a great example where that equipment clearly can't leave the state. And, you know, there's a huge opportunity there as well, you know, a significant one. And I'm sure there's many others. So understand you got to be careful. You don't want to be funding fleets that are, you know, going to be in the money leave Oregon or the benefits leave Oregon. So I understand the challenge there. I understand the concern for generating too many credits. But just looking across the landscape of where the opportunities lie, there may be more, there's likely more on the private side. So just want to throw that in there.
Yeah, thank you. If I could just ask a really quick follow-up on what you just said. So is it, you know the airport better than I do, is it just generally the case that once an airline drops equipment at your airport that it never gets rehoused elsewhere, or it just kind of stays there until the end of its usable life?
Yeah, it stays at the airport. They may shuffle equipment around from one airport to the next, unfortunately, where, I know it's been a concern with diesel equipment in California, but if they start to transition to electric, that other equipment, the older or the replaced equipment may be relocated someplace else. But, you know, under certain provisions, like under GERA and VW settlement, which, you know, I know is of interest, I think those requirements are that equipment be destroyed.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. John Thornton, you had your hand up next. Please go ahead.
Yeah, this is John Thornton, Clean Future. I just was going to echo the comments to make sure that you think about allowing private fleets to participate, particularly those private fleets that might be replacing diesel equipment, which you not only get the greenhouse gas benefit, but you get the other criteria fleet benefits. So, you know, please consider that. The other comment on, you know, making sure you don't generate too many credits, you know, look at California. They kind of have a cap and a rolling deadline where you can essentially apply quarterly, and, you know, as, you know, that cap can be adjusted, you know, as, you know, parameters in the program. So I would suggest you look at that, you know, just some sort of cap that kind of roll forward.
Gotcha. Thank you. Eva, you have your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Yeah, and I might be getting ahead of ourselves, but I realize we're only kind of on the first part of this slide. But I'm just wondering, are those advanced credits only for base credits? Or are you thinking this as applying broadly, including incremental credits?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We have, so as part of the application, we would have them let us know what they're planning, where the vehicles are located, if they're likely to be using a statewide mix or utility-specific mix, if they have renewables or they're planning on using the renewable energy provisions that we have in rule. I think it would be possible for them to request all the incremental credits. I think that DEQ needs to think about that a little more and just, you know, we're trying to balance, you know, the likelihood that the credits get generated, right? I mean, if they are on a green tariff and getting zero carbon electricity that way and they decide to stop doing that, you know, because there is a payback period, because they are, you know, required to return or buy additional credits or retire them against any advanced credits that are issued, but that they do not generate during the payback period, that just creates an additional risk for them if they, you know, move from a zero carbon power or electricity CI to one that's higher, and then maybe don't generate enough credits to cover the initial advanced credit issuance.
That's helpful. I think I'd encourage you and all DEQ stuff to think about how holistically, you know, we're not further exaggerating disparities between certain areas. I think echoing many of our other comments. But the other component is I'd be interested to understand how this might interact with other components of the Clean Fuel Program, specifically under, you know, UM1826 and then other utility dockets where there might be a requirement of if a entity is getting some kind of grant or stipend that they need to kind of provide aggregation of those clean fuel credits. So I think just thinking through how all that various components of clean fuel aggregation interacts, and so therefore would want to encourage you to include utilities as an aggregator there. In combination with supporting, you know, purchase of those vehicles and bringing down the cost of those upfront vehicle infrastructure costs.
Yeah, that's a good point to raise. I mean, if we issue credits to a fleet for vehicles that are advanced credits, obviously we need to make sure that we don't end up with double crediting, so somebody else generating those credits. There is some language in the discussion draft, and I think I've got some later in the slides around that. But, you know, we do need to maintain the integrity of the program and make sure that a ton is a ton under this provision. So, yeah, I think that is an area that we've been starting to think about, but would like to see comments on. You know, I recognize, I believe, under your grant agreements under 1826 and some of the other ones that you might be required by PC to aggregate those credits from that equipment. That would create an issue, I think, in terms of us making sure we don't end up with double crediting for the same kilowatt hours. Okay, thank you. I think Evan Nayland, I think I saw your hand up next.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. This is Evan Nayland of ChargePoint. Just a comment. I would just suggest consideration of extending eligibility to privately owned but publicly accessible infrastructure in potentially, you know, underserved markets or underserved areas.
Yeah, and actually, let me ask you a quick follow-up there. So I think so one thing we've been considering is that and how attractive this is for infrastructure projects and public charging infrastructure. You know, I mean, the nice thing for us about fleets is that, you know, they should know how much a school bus runs. They should know, you know, how much a transit bus runs and what the anticipated credit generation would be for those vehicles. It seems like charging infrastructure would be a little more speculative, but is that the case? Do you think that you could provide a realistic estimates over a couple of year span?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it definitely is more speculative. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea of this would be to remove some of that risk and speculation and target this towards, you know, areas of Oregon that haven't really been addressed mm-hmm. by the market. But I mean, that's a great question. You know, happy to put more thought into that and try and come up with some sort of methodology.
Great, thanks. Greg, obviously I saw your hand raised next.
Yeah, I just wanted to note, so in a lot of cases, these public entities aren't super interested in generating the credits themselves. There's plenty of complexity in generating clean fuel credits, and so they designate someone else to do it for them. And the existing rules for non-residential charging credit generation recognize that. So it seems like there's probably value in making sure that that's something that they're able to do. I didn't read 2AE about companies in this context to provide services to be that kind of thing. So I wanted to just raise that issue because a lot of these political subdivisions, and I really appreciate how broadly this is written to include lots of, you know, public entities, school districts. That's great for fleet electrification. A lot of these folks may not have or be interested in developing the expertise to generate credits themselves. So a designee provision probably makes sense.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to keep moving at this point so we can get to the next slide. Actually, so I'm going to take the next two hands that are raised, which is Mike Jepson and Annabelle, and then I'm going to move to the next slide. So, Mike, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Sorry, I was trying to find my mute button. I appreciate this list, and, you know, it seems like mostly what we're just trying to get at is you know, like public agencies and kind of some potentially private companies that are, you know, affected or kind of work in the public interest. And just kind of thinking off the top of my head here, I mean, the investor-owned utilities that have fleet vehicles to go out and, you know, repair lines and kind of trim vegetation around transmission. It seems like the utilities do have a lot of vehicles that they use in that capacity, and potentially enabling them to get credits to change their fleets could be a benefit. You can link it to, you know, only serving service areas in Oregon as a way to kind of keep the benefits of the electrification in the state. And I would like to echo some of the comments earlier about ways to kind of find ways to expand this to ports. I know that that's an area where there's a lot of electrification benefits that I think could potentially come. So just kind of starting to think about this a little bit, and I can do some more digging and offer some written comments as well.
Great, thanks. Annabelle, Drayton, please go ahead.
Yes, hi, Annabelle Drayton with Northwest Energy Coalition. On a couple things, I want to echo Dee's comment on the like nonprofits that provide public services or act in public interest. I also think of like community action agencies as an example, or organizations providing weatherization, things like that. That there could be value in advancing credits. And I think there could be value in ensuring ports have access to this. One thing that I think is interesting, like, I hear that on the utility piece, for those, you know, the programs under UM 1826 and for some of the ratepayer, funded programs, there have been some stipulations that they're like, the credits will be kind of, handed over to the utility. And so I wonder how that, I guess I'll just echo that. I wonder how that would work here. But on the utilities themselves, like getting advanced credits, I guess I just wonder if it's necessary considering the utility can spread the cost recovery out over many years, whereas like the upfront cost could be substantially harder for some of these other entities. So I'm not opposed to it, just wondering if it's, if there are other mechanisms the utility can use in kind of, acquiring some of this technology. And then the last piece is on public charging. I am not opposed to public charging since it's infrastructure in the ground and provides benefits. Being eligible, I would say it would be really important for public charging to include certain requirements around accessibility if they were to receive advanced credits. And I would encourage you all, and I can send this, to look at California DVSC standards, as well as their electric vehicle fueling system regulations, which is more on like weights and measures and what rates are allowable. So I can send that over, but I would definitely look at those as a starting point.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to do the next slide and then...
Well, could I follow up with something both that Annabelle and Eva raised? So I get what you're kind of going for, is that in as much as there are some of the UN 1826 projects that are, you know, that could fall under this advanced crediting provision. So say, for example, a school bus, you know, that is gets received grants from one of the 1826 programs. And so I guess, so then, you know, just kind of thinking it out. So if a school bus does come in and apply, a school district, excuse me, comes in and applies for an advanced credit, but those base credits typically would go back to the utility under the grant agreement. So you're saying that, you know, so say, for example, if we agree to a 5-year advanced crediting agreement here, that all of those credits would go to the utility as well, and then how that payback period and how the paying back of those advanced credits would need to be structured is something that we need to look at, right? That's what you're saying?
I was just wondering how you're thinking about it. I'm not sure that I have a response today on how it should go. We can certainly think about that and provide some comments, additional comments. But it's just something I'm conscious of, as like that's been a requirement of stakeholders to further support the clean fuel programs, funded programs, like putting that back into the grant funding. And it's kind of a continuation. And so I was just curious about how that would work and want to make sure.
Yeah, sure.
That initial investment continues in the way it was intended.
Yeah, absolutely. And even going back to your first comment, Eva, I think it's kind of like, so what if we're talking about one of your customers that is subscribed to, you know, your Blue Sky, and so could theoretically generate incremental credits on top of that, right? Whether some kind of this kind of agreement could encompass base credits, incremental credits, advance through a utility program, right? So that kind of like those kinds of considerations. Yeah, they get pretty detailed. So we'll think about that as we move forward.
Okay, I'm going to take the remaining raised hands and the comments in the chat after I get through the next slide, just to keep us moving slightly forward in the deck. In terms of the... Can you mute your... In terms of the vehicles that would be eligible for this, what we're proposing is that the vehicles must be registered and based in the state of Oregon, and that the vast majority of their miles be spent in Oregon. We would have the entity applying up front make some sort of documentation of that fact, you know, as part of the application. So they would need to show us that, you know, that vehicle is intended for use in state as part of whatever agreement we have. If we approve them, they would need to, you know, basically agree to, yeah, we're going to keep this in Oregon through at least the payback period and make sure that the credits actually do get generated in state. Our proposal is that any medium or heavy duty vehicle would be eligible to receive advanced credits, but for light duty vehicles, they would only be eligible to receive advanced credits if it's part of the organization's plan to fully electrify its fleet within a 15-year time period. The 15-year time period is something that DC staff came up with after some debate amongst ourselves. I think we're still trying to figure out if it's kind of a Goldilocks question here, right? You know, is 15 years too long? Is it too short? Is it just right? And that's something that, you know, we wanted to get for comments. Jana, you have your hand raised, so I'll go to you first, and then we've got a couple questions in the chat that I'll take after that.
Thanks, Jana Gaston with the Oregon Environmental Council. I just wanted to go back to the previous conversation a little bit about really appreciating the idea of risk mitigation for advanced credits, because we do want these to be real emissions reductions over the time frame identified. And wondering if there's a couple different methodologies we could think about for that. One is identifying the fleets that are eligible, but also potential differences in time periods for advancing credits, maybe for a really stable public fleet, it's a longer time period of advanced credits, like a 5-year or something. And then others, maybe it's a shorter window, just again for a little bit of risk mitigation. And then I'm curious about how this slide sort of overlays with the previous slide. If there are public fleets, is this then saying, like, if a state agency wanted to do advanced credit, they have to have a commitment to electrifying their entire fleet, or is this for non-public fleets?
Under the current rules, it's for both. So for the electrification, it's just for any light-duty vehicles they want to receive advanced credit for. I think our judgment there was that the light-duty vehicle market is much more mature. The cost differences between, you know, a Chevy Bolt and other light-duty cars are not that great. With where we're advancing credits, we want to make sure that it's creating some additional driver towards electrification. And I think our judgment was that the light-duty side is further along than the heavy-duty side. So that was the reason there. But yeah, so if the entities on the prior slide can apply for the vehicles on this slide. And there was one question in the chat I'll take really quickly about, is the definition of an electric vehicle only battery electric or in a vehicle's electric drivetrain? And for this provision, we're proposing just battery electric. So it wouldn't include hydrogen fuel cell vehicles at this time. And part of that would also just be due to some we would also need to figure out how to, I mean, hydrogen's a bit more complicated just because of the fuel producer of hydrogen is eligible for crediting. So if the fuel producer and the fleet are different, then that would also create some more issues around how we make sure that the program is paid back. And then I have two questions in the chat from Michael Graham. So the first is, would you consider providing additional credits or credit forgiveness if an eligible entity were to scrap a diesel vehicle slash equipment with the new electric vehicle slash equipment, which is funded through the credit advancement mechanism? So the answer to that is no, because we need to ensure that all issued credits represent real reductions in the program. We're moving forward issuance earlier in this advanced crediting provision, but we still need to make sure that every credit that gets issued represents a ton of production as measured against our standards in the program. This is the same reason why we couldn't do credit multipliers or some of the other things that we discussed in that first meeting. All credits need to represent real tons reduced under this program. So that would also mean that we can't forgive credits. As you'll see in the discussion draft and as we'll get to in a later slide, if we issue credits under this provision, the entity that the credits are issued to, if they don't end up generating those advanced credits, they would need to pay them back. If we are trying to mitigate risk to the environment and to the program by, having these provisions in there. His second question is regarding light duty. When stating electrified fleet, is this the entire organization's fleet or just the light duty portion of the organization's fleet? As it's currently written, it's the entire fleet. You'd like to give us comments on how we could define subset of the fleet, that would help. I think at least for our initial proposal here, we're saying the entire fleet would need to be electrified. And then there's a final question about would you consider plug-in electric hybrids as well? I think we could consider that right now. The provision is more aimed at fully electric vehicles. And then we have another question from David Breen at the Port of Portland. Since non-road vehicles don't register, could a certification verification process enable hours of operation in Oregon be used? Yeah, I think that if there are vehicles that are not titled with DMV or motor carrier, that we could discuss how to ensure that those vehicles are based in and operating in within Oregon if they don't have registration with DMV or motor carrier. And that's a good point, Grace. If you have some proposed way of doing that, that would be great to see in comments. Janet, you have your hand raised. Is that from earlier? Do you have an additional comment or point you'd like to make or question? Okay,
Let me just jump in here too. I mean, I think, we'll go back to kind of like what the purpose of what we're trying to achieve here in this division. It is to increase the amount of CEs, but I think, I guess how I've been describing it, in previous discussions as well is, these are the cases where the business case is a traditional business case doesn't necessarily exist yet. That makes it like really, idiot proof, really just, to go and transform these vehicles from their traditional fuels to electrification. I think this makes a lot of sense in the medium heavy duty space as the technology kind of commercializes. I think if you think about a lot of what we talked about with the eligible parties as well, I think what you're seeing here is that our attempt to kind of focus more on things that do serve a greater public service, things that can make a difference in an equity perspective as well. I think when you talk about providing public transit and school kids getting to, school, and garbage trucks that are in your neighborhood every week, and those kinds of things. That's kind of the spirit of what we were kind of shooting for. I think the other suggestions about heavy duty fleets, private fleets and non-road fleets and those kind of things, make sense from the trying to improve the business case sense. And I think for me, it's like I also want to be able to have a sense for how this is actually, improving public health and improving air quality and those kinds of things. And just to kind of like clarify the light duty thing too. I mean, I'll use the example of say something like a climate where they have stated long term plans to to convert their service fleet as well as their non-service fleet. You know, entirely different applications, different timelines, but, you know, we recognize the fact that they have this goal of doing this. And so, you know, in as much as the advancing credit could help that full fleet conversion of the non-service light duty vehicles, you know, again, that's kind of like what the intent I was going for. But very much open to other kinds of situations where you think it makes that kind of sense as well.
Okay, so I'm not seeing any hands raised, so I'm just going to keep moving to the slide deck a little bit. For the next part, for the application process, we're proposing in the draft rules that we'd have an application window, basically, at least once a year. The applications that somebody who wants to get advanced credits, you need to submit to us would have to include a letter describing the proposal, including the number of vehicles that would be covered by it, charging equipment, what time frame the purchases and installation will be occurring in, a detailed estimate of the potential credit generation, including miles driven, energy, electricity dispensed, et cetera. The et cetera here also would cover, what the carbon intensity of that electricity would be. Details about the charging equipment and how DQ could be assured that credits will not be generated by another entity. Information about the carbon intensity of electricity to be used, a proposed number of credits per vehicle, which would also include, this many years of credits that are being advanced. And an attestation of the vehicles will remain under the ownership of the applicant through the payback period. So I'll pause there, give them a moment to raise your hand. And there is one question from Tom Van Heek. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your last name there, from GM. Sorry if I missed this, but how does DEQ propose to vet an LD fleet conversion plan? What must it demonstrate? So given that, I think we would want to see the plan, we would want to see the commitment, in the case of a, political subdivision of the state, that might be something that's been signed off on by a county or city council, so we'd want to see that. For a private entity that's looking at fleet conversion on the light duty side, I think we'd want to see their commitment to doing so. Obviously that would hopefully be a public commitment and not just something that they're submitting to us. I think we're thinking through how we would review these applications and how we would review those plans. The first hand I saw raised was Annabelle Drayton. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Just a quick question on the level of difficulty this may be for some small public fleets, like a school district, a detailed estimate of potential credits and things like that. Just wondering how much support these two can provide in this application process.
Yeah, our intent is to and we're still thinking through exactly how we would do this internally and when we get to the implementation side of this provision. We would have some, notice ahead of time when we're going to be accepting applications. We would offer technical assistance to those entities. We have an obligation estimator on our website that we would help those applicants use in order to determine and do the estimates for credit generation. When we've had discussions in the past with fleets that are looking at generating clean fuel burn credits, it's usually been can we identify what energy economy ratio would be used by that vehicle? Do you have a number of miles traveled by the vehicles you're replacing? And then, based on manufacturer data or something else, can we figure out, that many miles would equal about this many kilowatt hours and then plug that in for credit generation? Our goal is to provide as much technical assistance as we can to applicants. There are only a handful of us, so I think we are a little bit limited in bandwidth, which is why we're considering having it be one application period a year so that we could work it in when CFP staff are most available during the year, not right during the middle of the annual compliance determinations or something.
That's super helpful, thank you.
Yeah.
I think additionally, Annabelle, part of the reason, and I apologize for kind of being fixated on transit bus school bus thing, but I spend a lot of time thinking about transit bus and school bus. But these are areas too where through collaborations with other state agencies and you know, where we've actually spent a bunch of time thinking about how can we, you know, development of a transit tool, right, transit bus tool or a school bus tool that can actually calculate out some of this initial numbers about, you know, how much electricity and what the cost of the replacement vehicles are going to be, that kind of thing. I think we put together some good materials as far as, you know, user guides, as far as walking, you know, a transit agency or a school district, you know, through that process, at least initially to get to the point where they're interested in it. And then I can see how that kind of outreach would kind of dovetail into, you know, technical assistance for an application process here. I think I'll also at this time kind of mention that we have reached out to ODOT Transit to talk to them about their communications with transit agencies, what their process is of communication and gauging interest about which transit agencies are interested in going to alternative fuels. They have CIF funds. They are familiar with federal transit dollars and zonal grants and all those other kinds of things that could be a part of a package of incentives that could really get transit agencies to move. Actually, later today, I'm having a call with the Department of Education, Civil Transportation Services Manager to talk about that same kind of interaction with the school districts. And, you know, and in as much as the utilities have been really, aggressive, you know, courting school districts to convert to electric school buses, I think they've laid a lot of the groundwork for like kind of this communication about trying to incent more of that. On the garbage, hauler side, we met with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association to get some of their members' feedback as far as, you know, like how a garbage hauler might be able to play in this provision as well. And so, you know, it's like we're trying to reach out to certain entities to get a better feel for does this make sense? What are the details? How it would really be effective moving forward? Because what I think for me, what this is trying to get from is the one-off pilot programs to do more, right? I don't want one bus. I want 5 buses. I want 20 buses. I want 100 buses. Or, you know, I want the entire fleet of garbage trucks or that kind of thing. And how do we really start moving the needle beyond the pilot project is what I have in my head. It could be that this provision in and of itself is not going to make the thing that, you know, makes a fleet make that kind of decision. But I would like it to be a kind of provision that would actually move the needle beyond the one-off. So.
And so I've got one quick question that's got them to take that's related to what we were talking about, and then I'll move to the next hand raise. So Kelly Hale with Wayne Transit District asks, is the estimate of the potential credit generation based on a form from DQ, or does the agency put that together themselves? So Kelly would have the applicant put it together. I think it's definitely envisionable that for some applications, like transit buses or school buses, we might have like be able to provide a version of the obligation estimator where they can plug in some of the numbers themselves to come up with that estimate. I think, as you know, Cora was mentioning, we're also looking at some other vehicle types that where we might not have as many variables we could define ahead of time. You know, we and as the other agencies of the state, like, you know, ODOT Transit and, you know, the department that, you know, spend a lot of time with fleets like yours. They don't necessarily spend as much time with like garbage haulers or other fleets. So I think we would have them come to us with that estimate, and then we would vet that during the application process. We would try to provide more materials over time to make it easier on folks to do that. And I think especially once we get to a cycle or two of these, we probably have a pretty good idea about, you know, what are the questions that people have, what data can they provide, and, you know, that might lend itself to us providing more material for them to fill out. Okay, so the next hand raised was Stephen McDonald. So please go ahead, and then Jessica Spiegel, you're up next.
Excellent, thank you. Now, this is a question for Corey. Just speaking about the parameters of the scope of this, you were talking about it seems like this application process is based on heavily calculated dynamics. Are you guys looking at implementing a real-time dynamic system that can be locational specific. It can tag and it can, you know, record, you know, locationally specific usage, and then that could be the basis for building credits? Or is this all going to be preliminary assumptions that builds the credits? Thanks.
Yeah, I would say more of the latter. You know, I don't think, my guess is that the potential applicants here won't have that kind of real-time data. You know, I think they'll know number of miles on a route that, you know, typical buses travel, and that kind of thing. I think they would know, you know, historical fuel use data and be able to convert that to electricity. But I don't anticipate that they have any kind of detailed information. So, I mean, and this is where I think the technical assistance and the negotiation between the applicant and the agency will be important, because, you know, I think we have a better sense about, you know, a conservative yet, you know, accurate kind of forecasting of what we think and what we anticipate usage and credit generation would be over, you know, several years in the future. And that would be part of kind of crafting and negotiating what the terms of that agreement are.
Right. And I was just thinking that maybe, you know, on the M&G side, you know, the DEQ could, you know, from an agency standpoint, work with like UM 2005 on the DSP side, you know, to implement some kind of a real-time process that we can provide to residents of Oregon. Being an Oregon resident myself, you know, that makes sense for verification that these credits are double counted, that, you know, and that technology already exists now. It's not like it's not existent. So just thinking about, you know, adding the value to your point earlier of expanding this benefit to a broader audience of Oregon.
I think what, when you say that, you know, what residents have seen is that, you know, so there would be this upfront negotiation of what the advanced credits are, but when we actually issue the credits and when you start actually using it, placing service and doing reporting, I mean, that's the kind of valuable information that will be really helpful for us to make sure that the actual driven miles and the actual dispensing of the electricity was within reason of how we did the negotiation, and so we can actually track the credit generation a lot better.
Right. Yes. Excellent. Thank you.
Jessica, you're up next.
Hey, this is Jessica with RISPA, and I am a little surprised about just how generally broad this is, especially relative to California, and just kind of was thinking it through in terms of the fact that in Oregon, we have the provision that lets you adjust the program to allow more credits in if there's a concern about volume. And with this, there's so many advanced credits coming in, which are more controlled in California, as I understand it. So trying to get my head around that part of it a bit. And there's sort of a flavor of this that starts to be technology preferring, and that's the other part that's concerning me. And I realize we're in electricity rulemaking, but just the way this is coming and looks, it looks pretty surprisingly broad, is the way I'll put it, Hilo.
Yeah, thanks for that comment, Jessica. What you're seeing is the broad language, and I think what we're looking for feedback on from the stakeholders is ways that we can narrow it, but what we're also hearing too is ways that we can expand it, right? And I think different people have different ideas about the value of this kind of proposal provision, you know, adding into the program. And so with, you know, I'd like to hear people thinking about it. And I think the decision for the agency is going to kind of land more on, you know, do, like I was saying before, do we really need it or want it to incent certain things? So that said, you also made a comment about this seems to be kind of technology picking. And like you said, it's true, this is an electricity rulemaking now, which is why we're talking about it. I imagine these arguments and these discussions are going to happen when we do our larger rulemaking to expand the program. We've had lots of stakeholders comment that they want this kind of provision, expanded to other kinds of fuels as well. And I think it's fair game. I think the discussion topics that we're talking about now apply to other fuels. I agree to some extent with the electricity focus topic, but it's the scope of this filmmaking. And to your first point, actually, you know, with this amount, you know, with this, you know, it seems like a lot of credit that could be generated here. And that, I mean, I guess that's where I kind of point back to, you know, that's why we're having an application process. And so that there can be, you know, some control over the amount of these advanced credits that can be generated. I think one of the things that I point to is that, you know, there's a certain context to these advanced credits in the current program that goes through the 2025 standards right now, but I believe it'll have a different kind of context when we expand it beyond the 10%, which we're not, you know, addressing now, but I do kind of have to think about that moving into the future. I think what's pushing me forward with this kind of provision at this time is the executive order, encouraging the agency to look at opportunities to advance more credit generation in the electricity space and attaining the goals of the transportation electrification adoption numbers that the state has set out. And so that's what's driving it right now. But I agree that there's a potential that this crosses over into other things.
Annabelle, your hand's raised. Please go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up in terms of there's a general interest in this advanced credit provision across the clean fuels program. And just, you know, in line with the executive order 2004, really making sure that the technologies that are eligible for advanced credit support zero CI potential fuels.
Yeah, sure, Annabelle. I think the most likely one that that has been posed to the department for a long time now is to grant this same kind of advancing credit to renewable natural gas projects, where there is definitely the potential for a no or even negative carbon intensities. And that if it meets the same kind of criteria as far as, you know, there's an alternative fuel vehicle, and then there's infrastructure, and then, you know, so there's a total cost that is a barrier to entry for those kinds of applications. And I think the other example that's been posed to us quite often as well is hydrogen projects. I think is the previous question in the chat was this, what we're talking about right now are battery electric vehicles, not fuel cells. But in California, as many of you are familiar with, they do extend capacity credit provisions to hydrogen fuel cells and hydrogen fueling infrastructure as well. So, I mean, and those are the things that we plan to take up in the next filmmaking.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to move on to the next slide. So, for the rest of the application process, we would provide technical assistance to potential applicants. Would review applications for completeness, reasonability of the credit estimates. We may ask for revisions to or additional documentation for any application we receive. Our proposal is that we would, when we're taking a look at all these applications, that we prioritize those that, you know, would have vehicles located or equipment located in areas of the state that are disproportionately burdened by air pollution. If we thought that an application was approvable, we would then go into a negotiation with the applicant on approval conditions that would include, you know, number of advanced credits, the payback period, and then some other terms. So that approval process would include an agreement or something akin to that. We're still working through it. This is work on our side. That would need to include a clear milestone for the number of vehicles and infrastructure that are covered by the agreement. So we would identify how many purchases or how many, you know, pieces of equipment are going in, and for each of them when they're placed into useful service. credit issuance, the advanced credits would only be issued when a vehicle has been placed into useful service, so it wouldn't cover vehicles that are, you know, just being brought for testing. You know, we would need some sort of milestone the applicant could demonstrate to us that, no, the vehicle's here, it's working, and, you know, we're putting it into its normal service. The agreement also identify the total number of advanced credits to be issued for each of those vehicles or bits of infrastructure, the length and terms of the payback period, reporting requirements to ensure that progress is being made towards paying back the advanced credits and compliance with negotiated terms, conditions around the granting of advanced credits and some applications by the applicant who are in the discussion draft of the rules, and then any conditions needed to ensure that advanced credits are paid back to the program if the milestones and terms are not met. So if we advance somebody, you know, 4 years worth of estimated credit generation, and that's 500 credits, and then when we get to the end of the payback period, you know, they've only generated 300 credits, we would require the applicant at that point to, you know, retire 200 credits from somewhere else, or, you know, if they retained them, to retire those in order to make sure that we, the credits issued by the provision are real reductions under the Clean Fuels Program. And then I'll just stop here after I go through the payback period slide. We're also proposing that the payback period for advanced credits must be at least 1 year greater than the negotiated term of the advanced credit. So, you know, if we advance you 4 years of credits, then the payback period needs to be at least 5 years. So our question for everybody on this slide is, you know, is that a long enough additional time period? You know, how much longer should the payback period be than the amount of time credits were advanced for? But there, I'll pause, and I'll, you know, I can also go back to the prior two slides if anyone has any questions or comments they want to make on this.
Yeah, let me jump in, Bill. You know, I think what we were trying to do here is, let me back up a little bit. Even in negotiating what the terms and the conditions of the advanced credits are, you see that we've kind of laid out a process. We still need to talk internally amongst the EQ as far as kind of like the process that we're proposing. We very much like to keep it out of procurement and out of kind of some negotiated contract that we have to enter into with individual applicants. We know that that is onerous and it takes a long time and it gets really complicated. And so we were hoping, and we need to get feedback from the other kind of sections within the agency of whether the laying out of a process and all of these kind of you know, payback periods and those kinds of conditions and terms can be preloaded into the rules so that we don't have to go through a procurement process. What might happen is that there would be a SOC template process that we'd have to develop and get it approved through procurement once. You know, we could just use that template over and over again for different applicants. And so we're trying to figure out the specifics on that kind of process. I think what you also see here with this payback period is a way to kind of create assurance that what happens, you know, at the end of this, the crediting period too. We know that the kind of the estimates are going to be used to kind of create the agreement, the terms of the event credit to begin with, but what happens if that doesn't necessarily pan out through the regular use of these vehicles? You know, we know that it's not going to be completely accurate. So the thing is that, you know, if we negotiate 4 years and what happens at the end of 4 years, you know, we didn't want to be that stringent with the terms, as far as the payback of those credits. So this proposal here to extend it for an additional year, was something that we came up with to give the applicants, flexibility and time, to generate credits if it wasn't done during that original negotiated crediting period. I think what you're also seeing here too is that, okay, so, but once that payback period is done, there needs to be some kind of certainty that the credits that were advanced originally will be generated. And so this is what comes into the provision about, you know, so you get to the end of the payback, and if you're still short credits, you still haven't generated the amount that you were originally, you know, advanced, you know, then there would be the requirement that the applicant go and acquire credits and retire them to fulfill what their advanced credits were initially given to them. So we kind of think about that as a kind of whole package as far as how people can negotiate to get into this provision, and then all of the kind of like the contingencies where if it goes wrong.
So I actually have one more slide on the payback rate. Let me go through that really quickly, and then Michael, I'll call on you. So during the payback period, we're proposing that, you know, the applicant will report the charging by a covered vehicle or piece of infrastructure with their normal quarterly reporting, and that we would make adjustments to the online system to ensure that reporting does not result in the issuance of additional credits until the end of the payback period, or until the number of credits has been paid back. As soon as the number of advanced credits is paid back, then we would allow additional credits to be generated and issued. So DQ and the applicants would, you know, be keeping an eye on the amount of charging and the number of credits that have been paid back. You know, once, you know, you hit, in that example I gave earlier, 500 credits that are actually generated and paid back, then we would have them start reporting regularly so that additional credits would begin being issued. And then the other piece of this that I mentioned earlier is that if the number of advanced credits is not generated during the payback period, or if the applicant sells or permanently removes the vehicle or charge equipment from Oregon, then the applicant must retire credits to make up the difference from what was initially advanced versus what was actually generated in order to, you know, maintain the integrity of the program. Michael, you have your hand raised, so you put it down if you want to go ahead. Go for it. Yeah.
Thanks, Bill. Two thoughts on your questions on the previous slide. One is on the payback period. I wonder if you may also take into consideration the useful life of the vehicle that is in the fleet. Perhaps you're seeing really high utilization in some types of vehicles or equipment that may constitute you all requiring a longer or shorter payback period. I'm just not sure at this point, but that would be a good consideration to take into account. And then I'd also consider including a waiver option so that if a fleet does not have the ability to pay back the credits for some unforeseen reason, such as a pandemic, that they could request a no-cost extension of their payback period and, you know, given that extra time, hopefully make up the difference in the credits that they owe. It might be difficult to request a fleet to make up the difference with actual U.S. currency, just given, you know, maybe they haven't budgeted for that in that given year. But being able to provide that kind of mechanism where they could make up the difference with just credits would be, I think, beneficial.
Yeah, and just to clarify, we're talking about paying back the credits, not paying back any currency to DQ.
Okay.
Kelly Hale, you've got your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me, please?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Great. I just had a couple of questions. The first was, when would the payback period start? If you got the credits in advance in order to help pay for it, would the payback period begin at the point that the vehicle went into the revenue service?
Yeah, whenever it enters useful life. So in the case of a transit agency, that might be revenue service. Whenever the vehicle is being operated and would generally normally just generate credits if you were reporting a charging and it wasn't applicable to this provision.
Okay. The other thought I had is that, you know, some transit agencies and potentially other industries as well, but I know transit better, are not assuming that electric buses are going to provide a one-to-one replacement on some of the diesel vehicles. So I would just either suggest that the initial negotiated credit amount, take that into account when you're looking at the replacement vehicle and the miles typically driven of that replacement vehicle, or potentially you extend that payback period beyond just one extra year. To me, that seems a little short, just because, you know, by the time the vehicle arrives and the testing period that goes into that, and then the getting used to that range anxiety, it may just be a little bit longer before that vehicle is really maximizing the number of miles it is capable of doing. And also, initial calculations could be overly optimistic at the range that vehicle could achieve or that kind of one-to-one ratio of what the vehicle is that it's replacing. And so to me, one extra year seems a little too fast to be able to potentially get to all the credits that you might be giving them.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. I think it's a great feedback. Yeah, I mean, we did one extra year because we wanted to make sure there's at least some buffer, but I think, you know, potentially saying that's like 2 years would make sense. I think we would also allow the applicant to, you know, specify how long they want that payback period to be. Thank you. Okay, V, you've got your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Thanks, this is V from Climate Solutions again. I just wanted to bring up a point from a while ago, thinking about the light-duty fleet conversions.
Mm-hmm.
So for that point, you said like 15 years, and you were asking like if that's too fast or too slow. I'm sure you all probably were thinking about this when you came up with the 15 years, but just thinking of California's ZEV mandate for all vehicles sold by 2035 to be 100% ZEV. So thinking about that piece as well, and eventually like when this rule does get implemented as is, thinking about 15 years, or should it be like by 2035? So kind of like complementing that sort of work, especially if Oregon does decide to adopt that rule as well. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great comment, Dee, and you know, I have obviously thought about it. I think it's early in that process it's hard to anticipate what we don't already have in regulation. Obviously, Oregon and DEQ always look to see what California is doing as far as the regulations and what's going to happen in the future. But until that becomes part of our regulatory framework, it's really hard to kind of like incorporate that here. That said, I understand that lots of fleets will look at those kinds of signals in the market, and what California's regulation will do to the market, and will make their own decisions, regardless of what the state actually ends up, adopting as far as rule. And so, I mean, that does definitely play into my calculus as far as like what kind of interest is going to be in this kind of provision. I think we're taking kind of a wait and see, perspective now as far as, some of the light duty, only ZEV requirements. As well as the implementation and kind of the outreach that we are going to be doing with medium and heavy duty ZEV, and seeing what those kind of stakeholder engagements will be like, and getting a pulse for those fleets that could be affected by, you know, a California Advanced Clean Truck kind of regulation, about how it might come over to Oregon. Obviously, Oregon fleets are different. We have different kinds of just environments up here for business and whatnot. And so I think that's all part of the grander kind of, effort that the agency is going to be doing to see what the future regulation of these vehicles is going to be. But obviously, the Clean Fuels Program wants to and needs to be kind of in line with what those other regulations are.
Thanks, Craig.
I'm not currently seeing any hands raised. I'm just going to go to the additional questions we had on this provision. So I think we've actually covered a lot of these as we've been going through the slides, and we've had a great discussion. So I'll quickly ask the questions by way of giving you guys a minute to decide if you have something else you want to say or other questions you want to ask. Please add comments in the chat or questions in the chat or raise your hand if you have anything else you'd like to say on this provision before we go to break, because I think we will probably go to break at this point. And take a break before we go to the next section. So are there any other additional entities that we should consider? How should an applicant document the majority of the vehicle's time or miles are going to be spent in Oregon during the application process? What is an appropriate period of time to allow for that full light-duty vehicle fleet conversion? What's an appropriate payback period? And what are appropriate conditions for paying back advanced credits at the terms that credits were advanced on are not met? I think in order of the hands I saw raised, it was Greg Alderson, then Mark Ventura, then Stephen McDonald. So Greg, please go ahead, and then we'll keep going on the list.
Yeah, on the 15-year time period requirement, I guess I would just encourage DC to avoid requirements that could sort of gum up the works. You know, I think especially if that requirement is a full fleet electrification plan, you know, with some of the questions around medium and heavy, some, you know, entities may have plans that are more advanced on the lighter duty side. I also would just note that with the you know, on the light duty side, you know, you noted, Bill, that the like the Chevy Volt and the kind of small passenger vehicle class are, you know, closer to price parity. There's certainly other vehicles that are not as close to price parity yet that are in the light duty class that public entities use a lot of, like SUVs or pickup trucks or minivans. And so I just would note that there is probably some value in a flexible approach there to light duty, because I think we all are trying to, you know, if a public entity is ready to electrify, you know, 10 vehicles, we want them to go do that, as opposed to wait till after they've completed a, you know, year and a half long planning process. You know, those planning processes are important. They need to happen. You know, we're supporting fleet owners in our territory at PGE to do that work. So, you know, very supportive of that. But I think with this kind of provision, wherever we can avoid requirements that might come off the works or delay acquisition of vehicles, that's probably useful for the overall goal.
Okay, thanks. Mark, you're up next.
Yeah, thank you, Bill and Corey. One kind of a general point, not necessarily specifically to this slide, but on the proposal overall is, you know, we may not be necessarily, as you can imagine, supportive of the concept of essentially providing an additional subsidy to a specific fuel application. But if you are going to proceed with a subsidy essentially from CFD credits to purchase electric vehicle, why wouldn't you consider what's been proposed or being developed and actually adopted, I believe, already in California, which is a similar concept to provide credits to subsidize the purchase of electric vehicles, and it's not limited, I believe, to public fleets, but it's based on actual credits that were generated generally by electric utilities. Why wouldn't you consider you know, actual credits to do this kind of subsidy versus advanced credits? It's probably because it's not enough, or what are the thoughts there?
So I think you're referring to what's called the Clean Fuel Reward Program in California, where under the 2018 and 19 amendments to the LCFS, they're requiring that what we refer to as base credits that are generated by electric utilities for residential charging, that 60 to 80% of the value of those credits go into a fund in order to fund basically a cash on the hood rebate for light duty vehicles. So, you know, we did discuss, you know, directing what revenue should be spent on by electric utilities for base incremental crediting in prior workshops. You know, we're proposing currently that they would, you know, report out publicly what they're spending the value of the credits on. And, you know, we didn't propose that they, you know, create that same kind of statewide cash on the hood rebate that California has moved forward with in their recent rulemakings. I think what I would emphasize, though, Mark, just to repeat what you're saying, we do believe these advanced credits are real reductions. We're creating a number of, and I think you'll see that a bit through the slides and through the discussion draft. You know, we're trying to create a number of provisions that will ensure that any, you know, we're moving forward when we issue the credits, but that actual credits will get generated to back up those reductions. And if they're not, then the entity we issue those advanced credits to needs to make up whatever that difference is. So, you know, these aren't paper credits. They're not extra credits. You know, they are actual real reductions on the program.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, follow-up question is, maybe you've already addressed that or you'll address that in future slide is, you know, would you put a limit on the number of advanced credits overall as a percentage of, you know, the bank or something like that? Or are you considering some kind of mechanism to control, you know, a volume of credits, of advanced credits?
We're not currently, we haven't currently proposed that. I think that is something that we've been thinking about internally. That, as Corey mentioned earlier, is part of the reason why we're thinking about having this one application period a year so that we could, you know, see, you know, do it, is we have three applications and it's going to be 5,000 credits, or do we have 30 applications and it's going to be 500,000 credits that might be generated. You know, I think part of the reason why we don't currently have a limit in there is just given that we've fairly narrowly scoped the entities that can apply for credits, right? We're not including in the current draft, though I definitely heard all the comments earlier, you know, private fleets writ large, you know, it's, you know, we're just looking at public fleets, school buses, transit buses, and then potentially garbage haulers as well. So we think that's a relatively small pool of vehicles, so we're not as concerned with, you know, this suddenly becoming 10% of the market in any given year. But, you know, I think we're definitely considering that and we'll be open to suggestions on how to place that kind of a limit.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Stephen, you're up. You've got Andre. And just as a reminder, folks, please identify your organization when you begin to comment.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, this is Stephen McDonald with TMIX Incorporated. So just again to reiterate kind of the last few points, I'm still kind of going through the documentation of the rulemaking, and I'm curious, is this, I don't see any specific language or an approach described in this rulemaking so far about the M&G portion. And what is your guys' thought on the verification process of these credits?
Yeah, so for that, we would just defer back to how normal credit generation in the program works. So we require that all entities generating credits be registered with the program, provide reporting on a quarterly basis. For electric credits, we do not currently require a third-party verification like we are for other entities starting with 2021 data that was established in rules that the Environmental Quality Commission adopted in May. What we require is that when somebody comes in, reports data to us, that they report it on a per charger or per vehicle basis, and it's all the charging per quarter. So, and then we also have record keeping rules that allow us to request any underlying documentation and conduct audits of those entities if we think that, you know, something, either through random auditing or if we believe or have reason to believe that there's an issue with the reporting.
Awesome. And then again, just for my clarity, you guys are looking at, Corey, the real-time portion of this? In this docket, or is it in the future rulemaking, you think?
Well, I think real-time, you know, I think can have a couple of different kind of applications. I mean, for this, you know, as Bill just says, you know, the reporting requirement will be to report to the agency on a quarterly basis of what the electric dispensing would be, because that's how we calculate the credits in the program. You know, if there is real-time data that feeds into that calculation, sure, that's appropriate. I think the other time, the other situation where we talk about, you know, real-time data is more of the smart charging kind of applications. And we'll be talking about that later as far as the other topics. And that's, you know, that's something that we'll probably not be including in this rulemaking, but we'll be considering, that we'll be continuing to research and look at, and how those kinds of things can be implemented in the state. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I'm not currently seeing any other hands raised or any other questions in the chat on this revision. We'll post, as always, we'll take written comments on this revision. You know, sooner is better given the aggressive timeline that we have. And, you know, the email address is probably on the last slide, so I'll just switch to it really quickly.
Yeah, it is on the last slide, and I actually did have a deadline for the comments this time. So just to kind of give you a date to shoot for, by so it's next Friday, the 13th. So comments on this event credits provisions, and then also kind of working off the rest of the proposal that we'll be kind of talking about next. But we'll take a break now. How long, though?
Yeah, let's take a 10-minute break. So we'll be back at 11:45. Thanks, everybody. Sorry, yes, 10:45. I wrote 11:45 on the slide because I lost track time there. All right, so we'll be back in 10 minutes. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Welcome back, everybody, 10:45. What we'll do for this second part of the meeting today, as I described earlier, is to kind of like I wanted to do kind of a quick summary of all of the different other topics that we have talked about during this rulemaking advisory committee. There's been a lot of things. I'm very happy with all of the participation of you all in the stakeholder meetings, lots of written comments. I think as far as the website, I think everything is currently posted outside of the last two comments that came in late yesterday and overnight. So I have submitted a web request to kind of get those last two comments posted. I believe those are the comments from Tesla and from the PV Association and the Municipal Electric Utilities. And so those are two more that should be updated soon. What my attempt here is going to be is trying to be a pretty high level quick overview. I know we've got only about an hour ish to kind of get through all of the different topics. I know you will have lots of questions and comments about the things that I'm going to be covering. It's not meant to be comprehensive, so definitely ask questions. We'll take as many of it as we can today. We will record whatever goes into the chat and we'll respond to those questions in the meeting summary as we get that published. And again, we'll have comment period after this for about a week, I think realistically. And so we have to turn around those comments into the, incorporate them into the next step for us, which is draft rules. So let's get going then. So starting from the beginning, I'm basically following the format of the RAC number, meeting number one, kind of discussion paper. So the frequency of residential EV credit. This is one where the current regulation, does this on an annual basis, and our initial proposal was to move that to semi-annual, so twice a year. We did receive some comments on this, mostly supportive of the more frequent, credit generation. There were several comments that said that they wanted to move this to quarterly. And I think the thing that we ran up against is, as far as how we calculate what those residential credits are, we do rely on the DMV registration for that. And right now, DMV is not committed to deliver us this data on a quarterly basis. They're committed to deliver it to us on a semi-annual basis. So until we get, kind of more certainty from our sister agency over at DMV for the data, I think the most that we can commit to right now is a semi-annual credit generation. So that's what our current proposal is. Okay, the next one, directing revenue from residential credits. So the current regulation is that there is no direction for how the revenue from these credits need to be spent. In our initial proposal, we propose that the entities that receive residential credits submit an annual report on what those expenditures are. We did receive comments on this topic, and so the utilities are the entities that generate these credits, these residential-based credits right now. They are supportive. The comments from the IOUs was that, since they do have reporting requirements under UN 1826 for these expenditures, that we align or not even duplicate, the reporting requirements that due to the PUC the same as what would be reported for these two. And we're definitely open to that. I think the other comment that we received broadly was that if in the version of incremental residential crediting, if our automaker model was moved forward with, is that then DEQ should propose limitations on the expenditures specific to the automakers or the aggregators who would be reporting for them to ensure that, you know, the that revenue be reinvested into transportation restitution in Oregon. So those are kind of a summary of those comments. Our current proposal is to stick to this the middle of the annual report to DEQ on those expenditures. Our primary considerations and what was commented by the utilities is that this reporting mechanism should be able to provide the desired transparency that the stakeholders are seeking, you know, about what those what the revenue is being spent with, without imposing unnecessarily narrow limitations on the expenditures. And so we definitely get that, whether it's the IOU's oversight with the PUC or whether it's the COU's and their governing boards, you know, other decision making authority within those COU's, that just the reporting of what it's being spent on will definitely be a de facto basically direction on what those revenues are spent for. For the automaker model, again, comments that we received from several of the aggregators on the automaker model was that they do generally support that the revenues be spent to transportation electrification, and that however we frame this, that we just define it very broadly than narrowly, because I think the point was made that, you know, since they are in this business, that it behooves them to actually invest those dollars to create more electricity, more electric vehicles, and more charging and whatnot. So, but we'll stick to the proposal for the annual report on the utilities for their residential credit generation. Okay. So next, and you know, as always, please feel free to raise your hand and write questions in the chat. If you have any questions. So, next. So adding new energy economy ratios. So this is, you know, how we were trying to incent and getting in more new electric vehicles, to generate credits in the program. So the current regulation is that the only way that we can adopt energy economy ratios is through rulemaking. And so our current, initial proposal was to create EER adjusted carbon intensity applications, which we could approve through an administrative process. Again, most comments here were very supportive of having this alternative method to, you know, not have to wait until the rulemaking to be able to access these EERs, because that will be, like, most helpful to the fleet, you know, to be able to kind of get the most value out of their vehicles and the carbon intensity reductions that we're trying to achieve here. I think a specific comment that we received too is that, you know, as proposed, we propose a public comment period as part of the process for the EER CI process, and that comment period align with what is similar in a rulemaking process, just to ensure that all the stakeholders can have input. So, you know, when we do our rulemaking, we typically have 30-day comment periods. And so then the suggestion is that the comment period for once the agency proposes an EER-adjusted CI be 30 days as well. And so I think that's acceptable to us at this time. Jill, did you want to hit upon some of these other details that we've added?
Yeah. So the first was that we decided to further define the minimum data requirements. So generally, for any fuel path application, we need 3 months of operational data. Because this is these are vehicles and they're not fuel producers, they'll be in steady state operation. What we're saying is that any application needs to have at least 3 months of operating data covering a minimum of 300 hours of operation. So if the vehicle doesn't get used that much and it really, like, 300 hours of operation means that it's 4 or 5 months of data, then that's what someone would need to submit in order for us to consider the application. We also are saying we would allow for duty cycle testing to be used in part for that data, but that the applicant must consult with EQ prior to submitting such data. So, if you have duty cycle testing of, an electric vehicle and the equivalent ICE internal combustion engine vehicle, that you would come to EQ prior to submitting an application, talk to us about what duty cycle testing you've done, what duty cycle testing might be appropriate for this application, and that the agency would, discuss that with you prior to submitting an application in order to make sure that whatever you submit, we would agree with, right? Because we do want to make sure that whatever duty cycle testing is done, is as close as is possible in this kind of testing to what we would expect real world operation of the vehicle to be. There are a number of test cycles out there for regular vehicle testing. Finally, the other main difference in the initial proposal that we're looking at is allowing for the vehicle manufacturer to be a joint applicant with owner operators in state for their vehicles. So in this case, if we had a refuse truck and the manufacturer, in addition to the refuse fleet, wanted to apply for a specific EER for that vehicle, they would do so jointly. And then the additional change or proposal that we have on this specific provision is that if the vehicle manufacturer is the joint applicant on that application, once we've issued an EER or an EER-adjusted CI for that application, we would propose allowing additional fleets to sign on as joint applicants to the existing value under the that has already been issued, so long as the manufacturer sends. So if the manufacturer is producing one type of refuse truck and another fleet decides to also buy those, then they, with the manufacturer's assent, they can apply to the agency to become a joint applicant after the fact and also use that EER adjusted CI value. The new applicant would still be bound by the same terms of approval and pathway conditions that we have. So, we require additional reporting on an annual basis in order to make sure the EER is accurate, then they would be bound by those same requirements, but they would be allowed to use that EER in addition to the initial applicants. I think that's it there. I'll pause for if there are any questions there, but otherwise I'll move on to the next slide so we can keep moving.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of point out that, this is the next set of draft rules that we should have ready to get posted. I think instead of just waiting, until everything is ready, as these different discrete parts of the rule are ready, we'll be posting them to the website. So for those of you that are looking for draft rule language, check back often to the website to see the posted draft rule. Steven?
Yes, hi, thanks. Steven McDonald with T-Mix Incorporated. I'm just going back through the current proposals that you guys are running through right now. And the Executive Order 2004, as you know, gives wide latitude on ways and means for you guys to gain the net benefit of what the executive order is supposed to encompass. So it just seems like a lot of these suggested rules and stuff are really just additives of what is currently being done. So I'm curious on, are you guys going to address other means to accomplish Executive Order 2004 going forward, or suggest out of the box pilots, or is it just going to be kind of down the same lane, just additional requirements in the same lane?
Yeah, so I guess I have a question, Susan. Are you talking about other fuels, or are you talking about just brand new provisions?
Brand new provisions.
Brand new provisions, I think what you're seeing here is even previous to this formal rulemaking process, we had a brainstorming meeting to kind of get people's ideas about new things. And so I don't know if you were able to participate kind of in that brainstorming session, but I mean, a lot of these came from that brainstorming, so it's not necessarily just kind of like, you know, expansions of what we currently have, but it was thought that other stakeholders had brought to the agency that they wanted us to consider as well. Is there something specific that you were thinking about, or?
Just kind of, yeah, so the interagency relationship, right? So you guys specifically about how you're going to, you know, weave yourself with the PUC, for instance, right? That is, I see we have representatives of the IOUs here and some of the other smaller utilities. But I see the language that says, you know, we're specifically going to work together to figure out maybe a pricing mechanism, right, in addition to this credit, right? It seems like it's very heavily weighted towards credits. And so just outside the box thinking like that and the interagency interaction. So I'm just kind of curious on how that thought has been, where we're at with that thought. Is it TBD? It's the stuff.
Yeah, I think I would describe that as a work in progress. We have definitely consulted with the PUC on several of these things because of the interaction with the IOU and the different kinds of spaces that the IOUs do participate, you know, with the PUC. I think what you are seeing is that there are certain authorities that we do have within the Clean Fuels Program to be able to look at this, credit being the currency of the Clean Fuels Program. We don't have any other mechanisms I think that what I challenge here is that we're trying to incent more, but we do have a limited set of tools in our toolbox right now. So being able to use credits as that tool in different ways to do it. I think what another thing that kind of happened early on in this process too is just kind of going back to the definition of credits in our statute and, you know, speaking to, you know, a credit needs to actually reflect a ton of GHG reductions. Very much limited kind of the creativity that we were frankly hoping for in this rulemaking, because we were very interested in looking at other options. But once you apply that lens of a credit has to have actual reduction, then we were limited in how we could do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, I'm fully aware of the opportunity to expand the lens and latitude, like the executive order was mentioning. So I just, thanks for that. I think it's important to, like you said, it's TBD.
And I very much appreciate the sentiment and, you know, the desire for the agencies to work together. I will say that we do work really closely with the PUC. We work very closely with ODO and the Department of Transportation on all of this electric vehicle kind of discussions. And so whether it is, you know, either, you know, the charging network and infrastructure and education and outreach and, you know, pricing mechanisms and all that kind of stuff, we do have very active interagency discussions as well. So it's, and it, you know, some of it is reflected here because that is clearly in the bucket what the Clean Fuels Program can help with. And then some things are obviously outside.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, let's move on. So the next of the categories, and so now we're talking, we're moving into the second of the breakouts, so we're talking about renewable electricity. We know there's this pressure on everybody's minds because this is a discussion that was only 2 weeks ago. We have received lots of comments about these. Obviously, there are a lot of details that are involved with these discussion topics. We continue to get more comments, and we're continuing to research all of these things. And so I think this is a space where, even though I'm going to give you an update of where we currently are, we are definitely not at the point where we're set in even what staff's proposal is, but it's our current thinking. So the current, with respect to calculating the statewide mix CI, you know, the current regulation is this 5-year rolling average. And what our initial proposal was to do is to move to from a 5-year rolling average to the single year. And that also includes adjusting for the fact that about a quarter of the load now is specified under the utility specific CI. So then adjusting that statewide value to take those utility specific CIs out. And it's also the proposal includes, since with the closure of Boardman, to replace the emissions from Boardman with this 0.428 factor for the years of 2021 and 22 until the data, actual data from what PD's mix is going to be moving into the future is actually reflected in the data to calculate the carbon intensity. So we did receive lots of comments on this point, and they were generally supportive. And the reason why they were supportive is because this proposal seems is consistent with current carbon accounting methods. You know, on our effort, DEQ's effort to use the best data that we have, and just, you know, try and move those as these fossil facilities like the Boardman coal plant out of the mix sooner than later, and to get closer to, you know, a true accounting of what those emissions really are. The comments also rightly pointed out too that because when you do these adjustments that the statewide mix will be higher than it currently is now, that does lower base credit generation for the entities that are accessing this higher statewide mix. Also that the fact that it lowers the base credit generation seems to be counter to what the executive order is directing the agency to do in this rulemaking. So obviously, and we've had lots of discussions about this before, about, you know, not looking at this specific provision in isolation, but that there are a series of other kinds of things that we are proposing with respect to this CI. And so to kind of look at, take a more holistic look at how this particular change is layered with other kinds of things that we'll be talking about next. Bill, did you want to talk about some additional thinking that we have with this piece of the provision?
Yeah, so I think the other things you'll see once we get these rules out is that we'll include a provision to reissue the 2021 electricity mix CI. Under the current rule, we need to do that in December of this year. So, you know, if we move forward with these proposals, if the ECC adopts them, we would have a provision in there to allow us to readopt the 2021 value so long as the ECC decides to adopt the rule package that we proposed. The other factor that I wanted to call out was that we are proposing to, so the electricity carbon intensities have two components. One is the direct emissions, and that's what you would think of as just like normal smokestack emissions from power plants. The other part is, because we're a life cycle program, the indirect or upstream emissions, and that's all of the emissions that are associated with, you know, mining coal and taking it to a coal-fired power plant, producing natural gas, and, you know, any methane leakage at wellhead or along the transmission pipeline network that would be accounted for in those indirect emissions. Our proposed adjustment here is just to the direct portion of the mix, so we would adjust the direct emissions associated with the Boardman coal-fired plant. We're not currently proposing to make any adjustments to the indirect emissions, as that would be more speculative, and there's not as clear as easy an option to pick there. Also, I'll just note generally the direct emissions are something like 80% of the emissions associated with electricity, and indirect is more like 20%, so the adjustment on the direct side is more significant generally. Okay, so I'll move on to the next slide unless I see any hands raised or questions from the chat very quickly.
Let's move forward with the next one.
Actually, Greg just raised his hand. Why don't we take that one?
Okay.
Bill, I just want to make sure I got some right. I thought in one of these previous meetings you all had said that the changes adopted by EQC, you know, out of this rulemaking would become effective for the next year's CI, like for the 2022 CI. I think what I just heard you say is that the 2021 CI would change mid-year based on whatever the EQC adopts. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's our goal, is that if the EQC decides to adopt these rules in March, that we would reissue the 2021 CI. So obviously the reporting period for the first quarter of 2021 is April, May, June. That is one of the drivers we're trying to hit the March meeting, is that we could update the electricity CI prior to any electricity data being put into the system. Does that answer the question? Okay. Eva, please go ahead.
Yeah, and I know I've made this point in other meetings, and we did it in our comments as well. This is Eva with Pacific Power. And again, just going back to the governor's executive order, we understand you're asking everyone to look at this holistically, but I think there's a way to create that value from incremental credits without hurting those base credits and without hurting all entities that are generating clean fuel credits, base credits in IOU service areas, not just utilities. So just can't stress that enough.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. So then the next of the renewable electricity topics is qualifying RECs. And I will definitely say this is probably the part of the provision that we have received the most comments about. I know that there's a lot of details and then, you know, again, a lot of comments and, you know, I like this and I don't like this and I like this and why don't we expand this and narrow this? And, you know, there's a lot of moving parts in here. And so, you know, this is just to say that when we first introduced this topic 2 weeks ago, the initial proposal as far as the rest that qualify to be able to generate this the incremental credits and access to the zero carbon electricity by the retirement of RECs. What the original proposal was is for them, for these RECs to be green certified, that the balancing authority has to encompass the footprint of Oregon, and that the proposal was to include projects that were 2015 and newer. I would say that a high level comment that we have received from several parties is that there is agreement that by using these kind of specifications for what qualifies as RECs in this program provides the best incentive for renewable electricity projects that can actually benefit Oregonians. We want to make sure that we are capturing projects that actually are in Oregon, the electricity that does that can be delivered and is being delivered into Oregon. And that's one of the stated goals of why we're trying to use the BRAC retirement as a tool to lower credit, increase credit generation for these kinds of projects. We have also received for more specific details in here, requests to make it more consistent with the Oregon RPS as opposed to what we proposed. Request that not to require the GRID E certification, as that would add additional costs for the requisition, for the acquisition of the RECs. To broaden the delivery areas beyond just the balancing authorities that touch the state of Oregon to REC-wide, areas, or something broader to expand just the market and the availability of RECs that can be eligible here. Because the notion that this increased demand for these RECs will cause the price of the RECs to receive, or that there isn't enough specific quantities of these qualifying RECs to be able to kind of meet the needs of CFP and not have these kind of like unintended, you know, increases in the REC market. And so Bill, why don't you walk through some of the, kind of the considerations and the conversations that we've had?
Yeah, so we've had a number of conversations in the last 2 weeks about this provision. You know, we believe based on those conversations that there is a broad enough pool of RECs currently that would meet these specifications in the proposal that, you know, that would cover what we would need for this program. However, we have heard from a number of stakeholders that there is the potential for, the market in the Pacific Northwest is relatively tight for RECs, and this might create some additional tightness. I think what we would, we're going to continue to monitor the situation. We will, speak with our sister regulators at PC, keep an eye on what REC generation is qualifying, how much this provision actually gets used, and then we can make adjustments later. And as Corey mentioned earlier, right, we don't currently have any changes. We may make changes. We got a number of comments on this provision, and we're still reading through and considering all of them. And I think the other thing I would note is that we did make a change that I mentioned at the last meeting, where the vintage requirement now aligns with what Greenie requires, and you'll see that when we get draft rules published in the next week. Are there any, Eva, you have your hand raised. Is that from earlier, or did you raise it again? Or do you have any comments you'd like to make here? Okay. Putting your hand down. Does anyone else have any questions or comments here? Otherwise, I'll move on to the next slide, which also deals with Queen's baseless provision. Oh, there's a question in the chat. Can you please clarify the 2015 requirement? So what we're saying is that the electric generator needs to be placed in service in 2015 or later. So when the initial jet test started generation from that project.
Yeah, this is Corey. I just wanted to kind of clarify here under the bullet that says current proposal where it says no changes. I shouldn't have put no changes. I should really have said something like we haven't made any kind of decisions on this proposal whatsoever because there are still so many conversations going on and yeah, I did not intend to state that we are like not changing what from our initial proposal.
Okay, so I'll take this one. So after, in some of our discussions after the last meeting, we realized we probably should have clarified and expanded a bit on what we intended for the green tariff renewable energy product portion of the renewable energy rules. So our initial proposal was that we allow for bundled and unbundled RECs and then have some provision to allow green tariffs to also qualify for either a zero carbon CI or some other CI if the renewable energy in that green tariff or green product has some emissions associated with it, such as if it's from like a, renewable energy is sourced from biomass and there are some emissions associated with that biomass. So we did receive some comments on this, asking for us to clarify about how green tariffs and voluntary REC programs to use the claim zero CI electricity, and that voluntary REC program should have a non-zero CI if it includes some form of generation that would have a LIFO carbon intensity associated with it. To go back, our goal is that if a utility comes in with a green tariff, they can apply through a Tier 2 fuel pathway application process with us to have that green tariff assigned a carbon intensity. And then if a customer of that utility is on that green tariff, they can demonstrate that to the agency during their quarterly reporting that, my electric chargers are covered by this green tariff, so I can claim zero CI in my quarterly credit reporting for credit generation. So what our thinking is, and in addition to that initial proposal was, first off, for residential credit generation by the utilities or backed up by a regulator, if there is matching between the registered residential EV owners and those residential EV owners are also registered in one of the voluntary REC or green tariff programs, then the utility would not need to retire additional RECs to those EVs to generate residential incremental credits. So if they're able to demonstrate to us that, you know, 20% of their customers with an EV are already in one of these products, then, and the product, you know, had been certified by the agency as, you know, requirements for a green tariff or a green power product, then, you know, they would not need to retire additional RECs for those customers. They would need to generate incremental credits for the other 80% of their customers in that example. The other clarification I'm making is that for the green tariff or voluntary renewable energy program, they would need to demonstrate that the program contains a number of qualifying RECs or bundled renewable power, an amount of bundled renewable power that is equal to or greater than what the anticipated charging would be for electric vehicles. So to expand on that example a little bit, so if you've got a green tariff and, you know, you have 300 megawatt hours that meets the broader program requirements for what renewable power would qualify under the Oregon Clean Fuels Program, and you anticipate that you would have 200 megawatt hours that would be going to electric vehicle charging from that program, then we would allow that green tariff to qualify for zero carbon or non-zero. If, you know, you've got 300 megawatt hours that would qualify for zero, but the amount of vehicle charging, you know, would be far in excess of that, then, you know, we would need to have some sort of adjustment there or talk that through. But, you know, our initial thinking is that, you know, you need to have enough RECs in the product that meet our specifications in order to get that zero CI. The other things I want to clarify, so both residential charging and non-residential charging could use this proposal. For residential charging, incremental credits would go to whoever is registered to generate incremental credits. For non-residential charging, we're keeping it as we had in the last proposal, which is that the generator of the credits is also eligible to generate these incremental credits by being on one of these green tariffs or bundled products. And as I said earlier, we would use the Tier 2 CI application process to evaluate these. We'd also use a Tier 2 CI application process for any of the types of REC generations that would have a CI associated with them. So our current thinking is that we have a list of the types of renewable generation that we would deem to have a zero CI, so solar, wind, hydro, ocean power. And then for biogas, biomass, hydrogen, and I believe biodiesel, that for those generation types, the producer of the generation would need to come in with a Tier 2 application so that we can determine the carbon intensity of that electricity, and then they would be allowed to market those RECs and, you know, have folks claim that CI in the program. I've got some hand raised. I see one in the chat. I'll just end by saying we also had a comment around bundled purchases of power or power purchase agreements, and if those should also be allowed in the program. So I think our current thinking is that that would be a Tier 2 CI application process. So if somebody, you know, is using an electric service supplier, I think that's the right term, and, you know, they have direct PPA between the electric vehicle charger and whatever the renewable generator is, then we would handle that through that Tier 2 application process.
Before we go to the questions and the comments, let me kind of jump in. You know, what we're trying to intend to do here is basically acknowledge the fact that utilities do have these products and these programs that are available to their customers. And then provide a way for the customers to actually really streamline this process, right? I think what we're seeing here is that, you know, like a small fleet, a transit agency, what have you, you know, the potential for them to kind of get into this, you know, access the renewable electricity to retire RECs to do this whole kind of process is slim to none. There are very few entities that can do them themselves, but in as much as a utility that they're getting their electricity from can and do, and that we can roll this up into these kinds of products is what we're trying to streamline here. Anyway, I will stop there. And why don't we go to, I think Annabelle, you had your hand up first.
Thanks. I have just a question about what matching registered EVs to like utility customers looks like in practice. So like if it's not a municipal-wide jurisdiction wide green tariff program, how would a utility do that? Would it just be through like voluntary reporting from the customer that's on the green tariff program?
So my understanding is that a number of the utilities have access to Oregon DMV's database of residential electric vehicle registration, so they know what addresses those vehicles are registered at. We've talked about this with some of the utilities. I think we're still figuring out exactly how this would work, but our initial thinking is that they would use their access to the DMV registration data. They would cross-match that with their own internal records of what addresses are registered, what residential addresses are registered in their Green Power programs. And then they would make the results of that analysis available to DQ in some manner so that we could check their work.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. And then Patty Sakula, please, next. Sorry if I didn't quite get your last name right there.
Hi. Pretty close, Bill. Thanks. I'm Patty Sakula, and I work on some of the voluntary renewable programs at Pacific Power. And my comment is actually quite similar to Annabelle's. Which is, in practice, how we would identify the link between these EV owners and REC program subscribers. And I just wanted to hone in on the way you described in your initial comments, Bill, in practice how that would work versus what I heard you just say. The way you described it initially was a percentage of subscribers in residential green programs versus the percentage of customers that are EV owners. And then what I heard you say just now is a linkage between specific addresses. And one of those seems a lot more administratively onerous than the other. So I wanted to clarify what you meant in your initial description of percentage subscribers.
Yeah, sorry, I should have been more detailed in my initial description. So what I was trying to refer to was, if you've got that matching showing that 20% are both in, both have an EV and are in the residential green program, then you don't need to retire RECs for that 20%, but you would for the additional 80% in order to generate incremental credit. We are open to other methods than what I just described about the matching. I think we would prefer as a starting point, we, try to ensure that the program is as accurate as possible. We're aware the utilities have the DMV data. We're interested in hearing how administratively burdensome you guys think would be to match up, customer addresses with the residential data around EV registrations that you have. But initially we were thinking that, you would, do that matching of, what customers have EVs and that, are registered in residential green tariff or green power products. Does that help?
Yes, it does. I think we'll think about if there's some other method that makes sense that's probably in between those two things. Thanks.
Okay, yeah. And then your coworker, Jeff Susanna, has a question that's up. I'll take now. Do you plan, Bill, do you plan to make any assumptions about upstream emissions for the purpose of calculating the statewide mix in this proposal? So I think that's going back to slides. So yes, we do, all of the electric CCIs we've issued in the Clean Fuels Program have included, the upstream components of those emissions. So we would be, including upstream emissions. This is a life cycle program, so we do generally include upstream emissions in our carbon intensities when we issue them. For any of the renewable electricity, that would also be the case if it's one of those fuels that we think would have a carbon intensity that isn't zero. So, for a biomass project, that would include, any emissions that we, that are associated with, gathering the biomass and taking it to the biomass generator, that would be an example of upstream emissions that we would include in the carbon intensity here. Go ahead.
Oh, I just had a follow-up to that, Bill. Thank you. So, in
just to make sure that I heard that correctly, you today, in calculating the statewide TI, are factoring in upstream emissions?
Yes. And then what I mentioned in the last meeting was that we needed to update that, and that some of the additional CI attributed to the statewide mix was from the update to the GREET model that we did in a previous rulemaking, but that update hadn't been carried through the electricity CI yet. So we will need to do that next time we reissue the electricity CI. So you'll see that when we adopt the 2021 value this December based on the existing methodology of rules.
And do you have any anecdotal sort of information about how that would impact, just on a standalone basis, disregarding that, you know, the Boardman calculation and the pulling out the utility specific CIs, do you know if that in itself has a standalone implication for the statewide mix?
Yeah, I think it's roughly an increase of about 4.8 grams. I would need to double check, and we'll be, the data year I was using was 2018 for that. We generally use a 5-year rolling average for the direct emissions. We only use a single year for the statewide mix for various reasons. And that's an existing methodology for our calculation of the statewide mix. So we would be following that in December. And a lot of the updates there are partly just changes in the grid mix from the last time we did that update. But then also, the GREET 3.0 model assumes greater methane leakage from natural gas fire generators because the emissions intensity went up a bit on the upstream side for natural gas. So, you know, some of the additional methane leakage data that came out between GREET 2.0 and GREET 3.0 just is part of the reason for that increase of about 4.8 grams on statewide mix. And again, this will be documented when we actually issue this value in December. It'll be part of the post every year methodology for this, including the direct emissions and indirect emissions. It's a relatively short document, but we'll probably include some more specific language around this item when we do those updates later this year.
All right. Thanks very much, Bill. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you. Marissa, you've got your hand raised. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Marissa Bach from Shell.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question about the second to last bullet. So DEQ would use a Tier 2 CI application process for voluntary REC program.
Mm-hmm.
So just so I'm understanding, if a non-utility were to want to use zero CI electricity through RECs,
mm-hmm.
they would have to do a Tier 2 application in order to do so?
No, this is for the green tariff or green power program version of this. So what we'll have in the rules, when I finish writing them, we'll get them reviewed internally and get them posted. So we'll have basically a set of RECs that will automatically be deemed as zero CI. We'll have some that do require that Tier 2 application, like for biogas or biomass. But, you know, let's say if you just have a solar product that is green certified and meets the requirements on, so I'll go back to slide. So if it meets all the requirements that we have in this initial proposal here, then all the entities seeking to claim that zero CI would need to do is show us retirement reports and REGIPs that document that the electricity was certified by Greeny, it was generated in the balancing authority that has a footprint in Oregon, and that the start date for that project was 2015 or newer. Does that help?
Yes, so I wouldn't need a Tier 2 application for that.
No, yeah, just for the ones that would have emissions associated with them.
Thank you.
No problem. And then Mike Getz with Oregon Cub has a comment that I'll read out. So the utilities will also have granular EV ownership data when the customers opt into charging rebate programs.
Thanks, Joe. I can speak a little bit to that.
Yeah.
Speaking kind of in specifically regarding kind of the level 2 home charging rebate program and some of the other pilots that the utilities are rolling out, and would let PAC and TGE speak more to that, but just on the issue of, you know, trying to make sure that we have the data to know who's who owns an EV and is also in the voluntary REC program. I think that could add to it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think what we're likely to propose is that, you know, there are some like minimum requirements in the rule, but that we would allow some flexibility for how the demonstrations would come in. Yeah, we're still working this through, and we would like comments on that from utilities and others. Okay, so I'm not currently seeing any other questions on the renewable energy provisions. Or actually, sorry, Patty has her hand raised as well.
Yeah, I just had one thought, and certainly we'll take this away and think about additional ways to address this matching question. But is there room to look at a simple percentage, perhaps, of customers that are EV drivers, and then as percentage, apply the percentage of customers statewide that are subscribed to a voluntary product?
So are you saying that you would like do the matching once to establish the percentage, or like you do, what would be the data source, I guess, for determining the percentage that we use there, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Well, it sounds like, you know, if and I'm not the most familiar with the DMV data, mm-hmm. but if we were able to do a rough percentage looking at the total customers in the state and then the number of customers in our service territory that are EV drivers, and then take it statewide as one data source, and then we can look at statewide numbers of customers that are subscribed to a green program and apply those two percentages against one another. I'm just trying to brainstorm ways that would be a little bit more simple. And then, you know, you said what's the baseline, then, you know, we could refresh that on a regular basis, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm trying to think that through, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to fully grapple with that on the fly, so I'd love to see written comments on that, and I'll continue thinking about that, or we'll continue thinking about that.
Yeah, Patty, I think the concept that you're thinking about is just kind of just use, like, an estimate of you know, an estimate, and I guess my gut reaction to that is just that, so my guess is that, you know, EV owners are probably higher you know, as far as like subscribing to the green tariff type program, and so right, and so I don't know how far you can kind of take that assumption. Like you said, if it's maybe for some kind of initial assumption, and then maybe you know, with the utilities that are providing these programs, you know, some additional outreach to make sure. I guess, you know, just to get better data, right? As I think, as Mike gets has kind of pointed out, as you have other programs that incent charges, as there are more information about, you know, whatever, what have you, you know, to actually beef up what those assumptions are if we can't do a direct matching of EV owners with subscribers.
All right, Stephen, you have your hand raised, and after that, we'll go on to the next slide.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Yeah, Stephen McDonald with T-Mix Incorporated again. Just to that point, this is kind of what goes back to my initial premise, right, is it within the scope of this group to grouping you guys to put in there, you know, some additional research or additional tasks to look at other means, right? It seems like this, to Patty's point, it seems like it was an accounting perspective as opposed to, you know, maybe a technology way to solve this problem. It seems like this whole thing is very manually based. You got to do a calculation on proposed, you know, RECs and usage, and there's technology out there. So I'm trying to understand, like, where does technology come involved with you guys with doing some of these administration logistical things? Thanks.
That's a good point, Stephen. I mean, I think this is one of those places where technology could be useful in establishing what the methodology is. You know, I think in this proposal with the Green Tariff Project program, you know, I think we're starting from a place where I don't think that there is technology that you know, that is used in these based assumptions. And, you know, the, you know, I can see how the matching up of addresses and subscribers seems very crude. And so, but I think I haven't necessarily heard any kind of suggestions about how technology could be incorporated specifically in this space. Like, we're trying to find out what the residential charging is amongst these utility green tariff subscribers are. And so.
Yeah, and if we commented, you know, and gave you guys a direction, you know, would this rulemaking process be able to capture that? And then, moreover, would you guys do an additional review of that aspect, or would you just kind of incorporate that? That's kind of what the thought.
Yeah, I think how it would be rolled in is in the consideration about how we estimate what those what the electricity is, the crossover between the EV users and the subscribers to these programs are.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
You know, as a substitute to just, you know, an estimation of, like, the overlap of the address bus kind of thing. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, we'll move forward with the next slide. So this slide speaks to the, again, at the last meeting when we were talking about who available to, eligible to generate the incremental residential credits. The DEQ's proposal from the comments that we have received from that last meeting and conversations that we've had is that the utilities should have the priority to claim these incremental credits from the residential charging, that they should have first dibs at these. In this model, the utilities, you need to inform DEQ at least a month prior to the end of the semi-annual period, right? So we're going to propose that we're going to do credit generation on a semi-annual basis instead of an annual basis. So for every of these 6 month periods, at least initially, the utility would have to inform the DEQ that they intend to claim the incremental credits. If they don't claim them, then those unclaimed credits would go to a backstop aggregator. The incremental credits wouldn't be issued to the utility until we receive receipt that the sufficient amount of RECs have been retired, and then we would give them, allot them those incremental credits. So this model as well, so there is a backstop aggregator that would generate the unclaimed credits. This is similar to the structure that we had in the base credit generation for the residential credits. But the addition here would be that for the incremental credit that, so this is not the same backstop aggregator necessarily as the base one. This would be a separate aggregator for the incremental credit. And so the addition to this process would be the convening of an equity advisory committee to insist in the process in developing the work plan and then the expenditures of those revenues that can be focused on equity focused projects. And so I think with the next slide though, I wanted to kind of go over the comments that we received on this topic. There's definitely interest amongst the stakeholders to direct the revenue from these incremental credits to equity-focused projects. It is very prominent in Executive Order 2004 that we consider these kinds of things in, you know, the activities that the agency does in this specific rulemaking. I definitely see a way that a backstop aggregator model can support this equity focus, because we can, like I proposed, embed this into the process of having a backstop aggregator working with the department as well as the convening of this equity advisory committee to be able to do that. But I think there's still some questions about how it could be integrated into the utility model, where the utility gets the first claim to these incremental credits. I think there's been some really good work already, but I think moving forward, I think we want to consider how we can better integrate this. And I'm actually going to call on, I think I'm going to call on V. Pai Pai, on behalf of the comment letter speaking to the equity advocates. Via, you on the line? I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of like, go over what your kind of like, what your interest is and what your vision for, how this could be done or what concerns you have with the way that we currently propose it.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. This is the Sustainable Climate Solutions. And so this comment letter that we submitted, it was signed by myself, Annabelle Drayton from NWEC, Jeff from CUB, Brett Lawrence from FORTH, and Jenna Gastelum from OEC. And we pretty much provided comments on this section on recommendations for the creation of an incremental credit equity advisory committee. Recommendations for eligible incremental credit revenue expenditures, as well as recommendations for who should be eligible to claim incremental credits. And so specifically for this question that you all were talking about, I think one of the important things is that for the piece on recommendations for eligible incremental credit revenue expenditures. So I think regardless of if it goes to utility first and then to a backstop aggregator or it goes to a backstop aggregator first, we definitely recommend the DEQ to apply kind of hard guidelines for eligible uses of incremental credit expenditures. And so that was outlined in the Clean Fuels Program discussion paper for the first draft meeting. Specifically, that has a good list of, eligible revenue expenditures that relate to transportation electrification for, especially for, thinking about transportation electrification and equity setting. But also I wanted to point to the last paragraph of that section from CARB that really expands. So it provides all these different recommendations, but also gives an opportunity to be flexible to different transportation electrification ideas or programs that people can submit. So I think that is something that we definitely want to consider, just like how can we prioritize, or how can we ensure that there is kind of these bookends on ensuring that this money goes to transportation electrification programs while also providing the flexibility for communities to say, like, this is how we want to see transportation electrification programs show up and what we need in our community, and so they can apply for that. So definitely wanted to throw that part in there as well. And then for the rest of the comment letter, we pulled language from Annabelle's team at NWEC in Washington, definitely talking about, giving a definition for equity communities. And so we define them as like communities that are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, tribes, low-income communities, rural communities, and other underrepresented communities. So I would definitely suggest and recommend the DEQ, and ideally, just agencies in general, having a clear definition, and one that can be used for all types of like rulemaking or decision making within the agencies of what are you defining as equity communities. I think that will be super helpful in making sure that we're able to prioritize and maximize benefits in those communities. And then for the rest of the comment letter as well, we just mentioned, that the Equity Advisory Committee should also have some kind of weighted consideration to approve projects and our programs, so that they're not there just as kind of, that they're not there and it's like, oh, this is kind of like a virtue signaling of like an Equity Advisory Committee, but they actually have weight to approve or maybe deny programs, in conjunction with DEQ. on like an established set of equity criteria, but that should be considered into their responsibilities. We also talked about the Equity Advisory Committee, while, you know, for sure there will be like transportation electrification equity representatives that are part of this committee, the majority of the committee should have representatives that are representing, you know, equity and environmental justice needs and the needs and interests of these like equity communities. So however it is defined, and we defined it again as communities that are most vulnerable to the impact of climate change, tribes, low-income communities, rural communities, and other underrepresented communities. And the last part of our comment letter, I'll pass it off to Annabelle, who could definitely speak more to this. But talking about recommendations for who should be eligible to claim incremental credits, and so I'll pass it off to Annabelle now, if that's okay.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I think you summarized the Equity Advisory Committee quite well. On the who's eligible to claim incremental credits, the letter recommends that automakers not be eligible because it's not in line with certain components of Executive Order 2004. But on the, whether incremental, on the, like, considering who should claim incremental credits under the utility or aggregator model, we do lay out some considerations for statewide projects providing the most benefits to Oregon. And so we're recommending that incremental credits be aggregated statewide and that the expenditures support statewide projects and programs. And one of the questions that I think I have for what's currently being proposed by DEQ is how a utility model in which the utilities came at first can support statewide programs. And I guess it brings up for me like the reasons why statewide is beneficial. I think, you know, you should have that broader reach. But then the other thing I'm thinking about, I think who claims the credits first, and this wasn't necessarily highlighted in our comments, is I guess the value of an aggregator in that they can be an impartial third party that doesn't have a direct financial interest in some of the obstructing a program in a certain way. And I think that's another thing that needs to be addressed before making a final decision about who claims the credits first. So I definitely encourage using some of those principles in evaluating what's the, you know, best structure for the incremental credits. I think it, you know, so there's the statewide reach, the impartial third party, and then also for the Equity Advisory Committee, I do believe that representation would be best statewide to really cover all of those, you know, vulnerable populations to climate change. So all of those things definitely encourage consideration.
Yeah, and I see Janice's hand up too, but let me jump in just a little bit. You know, so this second of the bullets on the bottom half of this slide, I just wanted to make everybody aware this is definitely something that we are still currently working on. We here at DQ have reached out to our PUC staff to begin discussions about kind of like what is how the PUC's oversight role with IOUs relating to the CSC credits, right? So that's currently in UN 1826. And you know, there was just some very kind of high level kind of conversations about with 1826, it's the base credit currently, you know, how do you see, the incremental credits, are they the same as the base credits, would be treated the same under UN 1826, you know, those kinds of very kind of introductory questions, because I think we are very much interested in to see what PUC staff thinks is their current authorities or what their interests are working to the future. They, as a state agency, also have direction for, in EOS 2004 for equity kind of provisions. You know, they've stated that they're looking at statewide programs and not just, you know, utility-specific, boundary-specific programs. And, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity here to coordinate with DC on this particular item. I think, generally speaking, from the conversations, and, you know, I'll ask the IOUs to kind of, like, chime in as they feel comfortable with. But, you know, I mean, I definitely sense that there's interest on all the all parties to do more of this. And I think, you know, trying to figure out kind of the right path forward is kind of where we're at now. I don't know if it's in our rulemaking. I don't know if it's through a PUC process. I don't know if it's some, you know, other kind of agreement. And so I definitely see opportunity here. You know, again, I don't think this is the end of this particular conversation with Mark. It was still kind of like beginning to medium kind of as far as this topic. Jana, you wanted to add something?
Sorry about that. My computer froze for a second. Jana Gaston with Oregon Environmental Council. I do want to weigh in on this because I do think this is a really important issue area, and particularly for the program to live up to the kind of executive order trend goals of emissions reductions and equity. And I do want to point out, I think a statewide entity or an aggregator could serve a really interesting role in this case, and particularly thinking about an advisory committee. Utilities, you know, they're disaggregated around the state, and it's really hard, I think, to expect capacity to participate in every single one of the utility proceedings. And so I think it makes a lot more sense, especially if you're trying to advance transportation electrification in places where it hasn't been happening, to have shared understanding in a place where that comes together at a centralized aggregator with a really strong equity advisory committee. And so I think more capacity will be built and more understanding rather than things being diluted and spread out utility by utility. And I appreciate the role that the utilities have played, no doubt. And I don't think that this precludes strong interaction with the PUC and utilities as well. But I think for the specific purpose of an equity investment trust, a more centralized role makes a lot more sense than kind of disaggregated. But I'd love to continue the conversation on that because I know there's a lot of moving parts and pieces. But I see there could be plenty of partnership opportunities, but still kind of more housed, I think, at a centralized location.
Yeah, thanks, Jana. Okay, so again, you know, taking comments on this as we kind of move forward, I think there would be a lot more discussions about kind of the partnerships and collaborations as Jana just described. I want to move over along with the slides because we've just got a couple more and it's 11:57. I don't want to go too far over. And so briefly, the smart charging, I think we have just, we've talked about this as we've gone along throughout a couple of hours that we spent together this morning. But the smart charging, you know, currently there's no provision in our rules to allow smart charging to be able to, you know, access any kind of lower CI or retirement of RAC or anything like that to generate electricity credits in CFP. And what our initial proposal was is, you know, this is definitely a concept that came out of our brainstorming sessions that were pre-rulemaking. We know that there's great interest from the participants that participate in the California program, where I think it's been highly successful. You know, but there are some sort of circumstances that exist in California that are just emerging in Oregon. And so the staff's initial proposal was that we didn't think that we were ready to kind of move forward in this provision, generally because of the lack of data that we need to actually effectively implement it. We have received lots of comments from stakeholders that point to the fact that there is an emerging set of information that we can apply to the Oregon and the electricity and the carbon intensity of the different electricity sources that feed into the state, and that there are ways that both either smart chargers or vehicles, telematics themselves, can be able to provide that charging information to be able to really match up what the electricity is and when the charging occurs, which is what would be the goal of a smart charging provision. You know, we are very, very interested in this. We've dialed a little bit into the data and the technology. Right now, the EQ, you know, we need to take more time to kind of look at this and to research how to most effectively implement this provision. I'd say that a large part of this has to do with just the resources it takes for the agency to actually implement it. It's not just about the data, but it is about implementation resources as well. And we also know that there's going to be some continuing collaboration with the PUC and with utilities on this kind of an effort. I think this is something that everybody is interested in doing, whether it's demand management or time of use or just, you know, better, to send better signals to the market as far as charging and smart technology. So I think this is something that we're definitely interested in pursuing in the future, just not in this rulemaking. And we do look forward to partnering with all of the stakeholders that have submitted comments as we move forward with this. And just to remind you too, when I talk about a future rulemaking, we're talking about, you know, the rulemaking that will be kicking off in the later half of 2021 into 2022, where, you know, we'll see what kinds of advances in that technology and the information that's available. And again, we will continue to work with our partners over that time between now and then to make sure that, you know, that we can incorporate that properly. Okay, and then the last thing is actually something that we haven't brought up in a previous discussion, but was in the back of our heads. We intended to include it. It didn't really fit nicely into any other thing, but I think maybe a question had come up at some point about this. So back in 2017, when we we added Worklist as a vehicle that's eligible for electricity credit, there is, you know, two parts of this equation about how we generate, how we calculate the number of credits that it generates. And back at that time, we elected not to extend the displacement credit portion of the calculation. We just plain didn't know enough about the forklift population in the state and the potential for credit generation and whether electricity was going to play a prominent role in this sector at all. So we went forward with adding it as a credit generator and have been very pleasantly surprised that there are that there seems to be a great interest in forklifts, and, you know, in as much as, you know, the electricity displacing more and more of the fossil fuels that are currently used in those on-road applications. And then, you know, and then pairing that up with the fact that, you know, like we do have this displacement credit available for other kinds of electric vehicles. We currently apply this calculation for streetcar and light rail. And so, you know, to make, to bring the forklift to be consistent with how we treat the other sectors, we are proposing in this rulemaking to extend this displacement credit to benefit forklifts that are new as of 2016 and more recent than that. And the significance of 2016 is basically when the program started. And so we do want to incorporate this additional displacement credit. Okay. I think that's all for now. I know that this was a lot of information that we threw at you today. We'll get the slides posted later this afternoon. We'll get the slides posted this afternoon so you can have all the slides that follow this conversation. And then, like I said, there's the draft rule for the advanced credit. Is there any additional public comments that we didn't get to today, whether on the chat or by anybody raising their hands? Is there anybody else? Okay. So moving forward then, as a reminder, so the next meeting is November 19th. Please note that we will probably change this meeting to a 1 p.m. start instead of a 9 a.m. start. And so look for that notification on the, we'll have it on our website as well as I'll post it in our sub-delivery notice. The 19th will not be a fiscal discussion, but it will be walking through all of the draft rules. And so we'll get draft rules posted as soon as we can ahead of that meeting. And then the December 1st would be the economic and fiscal impact. And that's the one where I said we're time to be determined. I am aiming for a 1 o'clock meeting on December 1st. That's my hope. If we can get that other conflict kind of rearranged. Comments for this meeting, and I think lots of people have asked me just to, you know, we're accepting comments on everything, any of the topics. We ask that the comments be submitted by close of business next Friday, to ensure that we can actually turn them around, think about it, decide, you know, kind of make some internal decisions about how to incorporate them into the actual draft rule language. The way this works is that we have to have draft rules to be able to consider what the economic and fiscal impact is, right? And we have to kind of stick a pin in the sand at some point and say, this is what we propose, you know, albeit draft at the time, to be able to determine or at least actually even analyze, you know, what the economic fiscal impact would be. And so that's kind of the time frame we're working with. This is the CFCE 2021 at dc.state.or.us is the address that I ask all of you to submit written comments to. And as always, feel free to reach out to us. If you have clarifying questions, we will be posting audio and meeting summary as well for this. And any of the comments that are submitted will get posted in the future as well. So with that said, are there any kind of last minute questions, questions about process, those kinds of things? Michael Graham?
Will you be posting these slides? And maybe I missed the link.
Yeah, no, we'll post the slides this afternoon.
Thank you.
Okay. If that's it, then I thank you all for participating. Another really, really good discussion and feedback from all the stakeholders. It has been really, really helpful for us to be able to hear all of your thoughts as we've kind of moved through this process. And like I said, I know there's a lot of details, but I think there's a lot of really good stuff in here too. So I'm excited to move forward with this and be able to kind of package everything up as best as we can. We'll try and keep it as simple as possible, but you know that there's a lot of weeds and a lot of these topics as well. So again, thank you for your participation and we will see you later. Thanks.
Thanks for hosting.